We've got plenty of time for questions. If you have a question, there are microphones roaming the room. Could you please raise your hand? Somebody will bring the microphone to you. The usual pack drill, you know, name, rank, serial number. But also, please make sure it is a question, not a statement. I'll cut statements short and encourage questions. Please direct your question to the chair and or to the person that you think is most likely to answer your question for you. One theme I think came through to me just listening to four of our speakers this morning is around the importance of on-the-job training. We've heard about the need for increased skills in technology. We've heard about the increased need for flexibility in the aged care sector. Grant mentioned it in his presentation around bringing people into head office and giving them some of that corporate view of the world. In our business, we hold the view that on-the-job training probably accounts for around 70% of the skill set that people have. You can get a lot, obviously, and you need a solid base through the secondary and tertiary sectors, but so much can be learned from the people that you work with if it's in a structured and a positive environment. So it's something that I think I will throw to those on the panel. Perhaps Colin may have a view about that. He mentioned it from the Davos forum. Jane and Andy in particular, I think, you know, may have some observations around the importance of that on-the-job training. Colin?
I mean, certainly the... I mean, I think the it's clear that companies have and many companies and industries that have been surveyed, certainly for that Davos report, anticipate precisely that they'd be developing a lot of training internally. And of course, the upside of that is that you get a workforce that continues with you. Andy mentioned that you know, many people in Saab, the engineers, have been there for a very long period of time. You're investing in staff. You are therefore building that you know, long-term job security for them, as much as that means, but also the loyalty and so forth. But of course, on-the-job training is expensive. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you're investing in really high-demand skills in your staff, then you're also risking them getting a really good offer to go someplace else. So you know, there are some real challenges, and I guess it comes down to the, you know, one of the an important value in that context is, you know, just being a great place to work. You know, having a great, you know, valuing the staff that you have. And having a great culture, so that your staff, if you like, are a bit stickier, and they don't, you know, jump ship at the first and next opportunity.
I think it's the flexibility in workforce development and training is critical, particularly in our sector, where you need both. You need on-the-job training, you need the ongoing support of your workforce to continually develop evolving skills that are needed. But you also need the formal training and the formal education to top up the technical skills as well. But I agree with Colin, it's training and development's one part of it. If you don't have those human elements that are really important for people in the workplace, like the values, the culture, the equity issues, the flexibility, people wanting to come to work and be there, that really contribute to the workforce. Without that, you can train, and you're not going to have an effective workforce. So it's a combination of factors that gives you that effective workforce.
So I spent most of my presentation talking about attracting people into the industry and getting them doing the right technical skills and training that they need to do it. And that's an important piece of it. And but also the retention piece is equally important as well, and the attraction piece. And generally in the defence industry, the way it's worked in the past, it's been a boom and bust cycle. So defence companies, without a long-term vision, without a long-term plan of what the next project's coming down the path, and with a finite set of projects, they tend just to go to the market. They grab some people for 5 years or 6 years, and the end of that project, if they're lucky, they can get another project. If not, they ramp those people off, readjust the workforce and move on to the next project. And that's the difference we're seeing now with this commitment to skilled, ongoing, continuous shipbuilding, is that we hope to see now companies setting up workforces that are going to be workforces for decades. And in order to do that, they can't just go out and hit the market. They've got to start working further upstream into the education departments. And we're starting to see that now. Many companies are doing that, right through graduates, through interns, through schooling systems, right down into the junior years of schooling. My point, though, is that just cutting through to the kids today is a really big challenge. And I was sitting in an advisory board, a ministerial advisory board in another state yesterday, and the minister said, well, what are we doing to cut through to the kids of today? And the bureaucrat turned around and said, oh, yes, minister, we've made some pamphlets for it, and we've sent those pamphlets out. And I just sat there going, you know, here are dinosaurs trying to, you know, effectively connect through to kids today that are speaking in zeros and ones, and they've grown up in a digital world. And so we need to think more laterally about it. I think the second point is, once you've actually got them into the industry, into the company, it's about keeping them. And that's where companies will be tested to see about values, to see about how they look after people, how they invest in people, and how they give them the best opportunities. And even in cases, and certainly Saab has, because of our Swedish origins, have some of the best, most advanced sort of work-life balances and workplace policies that are out there. 6 weeks leave is standard, whole range of flexible work and maternity leave, etc. But even today, we struggle. We have a very low turnover traditionally. But a good example we saw recently, we had one of the students come in, an intern come in. We brought him on to 2 years into the graduate program, spent 2 years upskilling him, training him, moving around the organisation just after finishing the graduate program, which he finishes around about $70,000 a year, so we're not paying the minimum wage. He managed to get a job in machine learning for $110,000. Now, you know, 50%, over 50% increase in your salary, no matter 6 weeks leave and no matter how many nice facilities you put on, that's a pretty hard thing for kids to knock back. So they're one-offs at the moment. They're going to become more frequent in the next couple of years as we see this skills crunch hit. And that's the challenge for businesses today, to meet that demand, to hold their skilled workforce, at the same time restrict the cost of labour as it grows.
Thank you. Going to exercise Chair's rights once again and ask another question. It's a question that really came through Colin's presentation, again rising out of the themes of Davos, those critical thinking, the creativity sectors, the creative thinking, the ability to have social influence and importantly emotional intelligence. Joining that with a theme that's just come out of these responses around retaining people and providing really good employer of choice environments, to me it seems a lot of that does stem to people being and understanding what it takes to develop leadership skills and to conduct yourself in your businesses thinking as leaders. And I just ask the question, I guess, of Colin through the tertiary education sector, having seen a couple of graduates recently out of the STEM areas and talking to them about when they go into their businesses, at their companies that they're just starting with, what do they know about business generally? What do they know about how to work in a team, to collaborate, to be collegiate, but also that above-the-line thinking around leadership? General question, Colin, in terms of the tertiary sector, is it done well enough? Is there more that can be done?
Oh, look, there's always more that can be done. You know, we try and innovate in that space, I think, all the time. But, you know, it's one of those things, it's like communication, you know, you can never do enough of it. But I think with things like that, you know, we increasingly have students working in teams, doing assessments and so forth. We have students. I mentioned the huge number that we send out to many of you on placements. They do projects in companies and in businesses and industries around Adelaide, working then in a team, but in a real live workplace, doing real live projects. You know, and they get a real opportunity from that, and you know, come back to us, you know, more mature. So it really is a mutually beneficial experience, and I think it's hugely important. I mentioned the innovation space that we offer our students opportunities to develop those skills that are the things you need to be to be a startup, to be an entrepreneur, to work with the skills to have the skills that you need in that environment, and we're getting great feedback. The students who do that stuff for us, and it's a very large number of them, they absolutely love it, and you know, they just want to get more of that. So you know, I think we're onto something in that regard, and you know, other universities are doing similar things. But it's an important part of developing people to have the resilience, to have the versatility, to be able to tackle what is just this really rapidly changing world of work. You know, no one's going to leave university these days and do a 40-year career in one job. It just doesn't happen anymore.
Thank you. We have questions from the floor.
Yes, Stephen Halliday Advisory. We've heard about, and again, we're coming back to training here, we've heard a little about problems in schools and some shortfalls there. Colin's spoken about where universities sit in here and how there will be more shorter courses, that the nature of that training changes. One piece that hasn't been discussed this morning, and I appreciate there's no one from the panel on from this sector, but TAFE, where vocational education falls, how does this now integrate with the changes that will have to occur in schools and particularly with universities? Colin, how do our universities seem to be having to introduce shorter courses that have a vocational maybe flavour? Are we seeing a blending between the two? How is that going to work to operate in the future?
Yeah, I think they're going to, what we call the tertiary education sector is the vet sector up to, you know, through to universities, if you like. And I think it's a spectrum, and I think we're going to see a lot more movement along that spectrum. You know, it's been very polarized over recent years historically. I think it's going to be far more integrated. We do some things, you know, at Flinders, we do a number of things at the moment, both with AC Arts, with TAFE SA and AC Arts, with TAFE down at Tonsley in the network engineering space. With students who are qualifications that are TAFE leading through into university qualifications. You know, I think we'll see more of that. I think vet's got a huge role to play in, you know, creating some of the skills that are going to be needed in the defence industries and so forth in order to provide the numbers that, you know, we've been talking about earlier. So, you know, I think we're looking at TAFE SA and how that's going to evolve in the next year or so, but I think it's got a huge and very important part of the future in skills training, and in that short skills upskilling piece.
Yeah, hence my comments from a training and skills commission position. I see that it's over the last 5 years, number of apprenticeships are trending down across the state, consistently trending down. So it's great that there's a huge amount of focus and money are going to be pumped in over the next couple of years. $203 million is set over 5 years, so it's a huge amount of money. But the brand of vet training has been so damaged over so many years. I think we realise success when we say some of those kids going through the schooling system, and just remember that 42% of people who achieved a SAFE graduation last year did so with a vet qualification along the road. So they're doing the courses, but I think we'll see success when we have some of those high achievers coming out of the school system who choose to go into a trade certificate or a trade career rather than just automatically go off into a university. And again, careers counselling this week, I heard a principal lamenting to me that of her year 12 girls, career council had sort of pulsed them to see what industry they wanted to go to, and out of about 100 or so, 60 of them wanted to go off and be doctors. So we've got a long way to go before we can cut through to those, in many cases, high achievers, and to rebrand vet training to make sure that the kids today see it as just being a wonderful, fantastic opportunity. And if you look to the big manufacturing countries, the France, Germany's of the world, Sweden, you know, they have a narrative in their society that technical skills and training, and particularly trade skills and training, is really valuable. And we're yet to get there. We've got a long way to go.
It's almost a social issue around what's important to the community, and we all know that you know, the doctors are, you know, seen as important to the communities, high status, high wealth jobs that are valued. But until we actually work out what's really valuable to us for a healthy social community, then it's quite a perverse process around how kids choose their careers. And aged care is a perfect example, and we're probably going through a little bit of a change period where, you know, at the moment, I'm sure, I don't know how many careers counsellors that are counselling high-achieving year 12 or year 11 students at school saying, wow, why don't you have a career in aged care? Because it's just not valued. So we've actually got to look at how we can increase the value of these really important industries that are huge contributors to the social fabric of our society, and how we're going to work as a good society. And so it goes right back to our social fabric, I think.
Which aligns with one of your earlier points around out of the Royal Commission and the alignment of, you know, social aspirations with this emerging, you know,
exactly,
healthcare requirement.
And until we actually value people in across the whole community, value older people, value women, value people with disabilities, and then young people will choose careers in those areas of work, and lots of opportunities. So it can be technology, it can be hands-on, it can be architecture, it can be IT, it could be a whole range of professions in that sector. But until it's valued as a social, you know, it's something that's important, people aren't going to choose those industries.
So, Christina, I'm not looking for on the one hand and on the other hand type answer here. Are we going to see the Aussie dollar below 70 cents at any time this year?
Yeah, so the Aussie dollar, it's just sitting under 71 cents at the moment. The Aussie dollar, in terms of the major advanced economies and their currency, the Aussie dollar tends to be one of the most volatile currencies. So it's definitely a possibility we could see the currency move into the 60s. Our forecasts are for it to sort of broadly stay in the low 70s this year and finish the year about 72 cents. I guess the main factors there behind our forecasts are that in this sort of more uncertain environment where we've got lots of talk about risk to the global economy, Brexit, trade wars and that sort of thing, that tends to put downward pressure on the Australian dollar. But on the other hand, commodity prices and their movements are always important for the Australian dollar as well. And we're seeing commodity prices hold up at, you know, really quite decent levels. So that's an offsetting and supportive factor. So, yeah, we see the currency broadly moving sideways this year, but there could be some pretty large swings within the year.
We have a question from the floor.
My name is Jane Muzzard from the Council on the Ageing. I'm really interested. I think workforce revolution is created by necessity, and we have a necessity at the other end of people's employment life where people are really struggling to stay employed and get enough employment. And it seems to me that the five-year half-life of skills suggests that we're going to have careers that are, you know, first, second, third, fourth careers, and that we should be investing just as hard in education programs and training and indeed employment programs for older workers to attract them to industries like our tourism industry, like our aged care industry, indeed into our STEM industry, women returning from work. And I just wonder what your reflections on that are.
Sure, I'm happy to lead that. So obviously we get a lot of applicants in our parks as people think it's their retirement job, which is always interesting. But we've got to go through a significant retraining of people when they actually come into the holiday parks at a mature age. So we do actually employ a lot of older people. We also employ a lot of younger people as well. But we have programs like the Pathway to Park Management. So we actually get people off-site for a week of training. We take them into Byron, so we take them into wonderful places like Byron Bay, and they go into a week's training. But it is interesting because it's the people that have had the resilience. You talk about resilience. It's people that have had, you know, the small. They've been in a small business, or they've owned a stationery shop, or a little retail shop. They're actually what we find actually very good employees, because they can deal with problems. And a lot of them are actually untrained people. And then we put them in front of quite sophisticated systems. I mean, we are a systems business, and we have to train those skills. But it's the attitude of how to deal with a grumpy customer late at night and turn that customer into a raving fan. That is the skill that we hope that actually exists, and it's the system training that we need to invest in. But the older demographic for us is key. Holiday parks aren't that trendy for kids, unfortunately, so we don't get the university students. I think the Adelaide office is different, where we're innovative and we're probably one of the best digital marketing teams in Adelaide, so we can attract great young people into the head office, but we really struggle regionally. It's got to be done through training. We don't rely that much on TAFE, or we do our own programs, just because nothing was fit for purpose for us, so it's been quite important for us to retrain.
I'd like to comment on that one. So we know in elder care, and we've measured this, that our most effective employees are older women, clearly. But they're also the most marginalised group of employees. So what we have to do is actually myth bust. Okay, and Jane, you're good at that, so you're onto it, I know. So we need to myth bust the fact that older women in particular are not effective employees, because they actually are the lowest cost in terms of work cover. They're the lowest group that take sick leave. They're the most effective in communication and problem solving. They are the best in customer engagement. So until we actually accept the fact that that group of people and are incredibly effective employees, and bust the myths around and get rid of the unconscious bias around older women in particular, we've got a long way to go. And we're going to need them. We're going to need those older people, particularly older women, to come out of retirement or semi-retirement, and because they retire early too, and get them working for us.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your questions. And